course, we all know that logic itself is an outdated, outmoded form of human expression, friends. Yes, indeed.
Well, of course.
Excuse me. I found my nose flute. Sorry. Did you ever hear me play the nose flute, Herb? Okay. You want to hear a little more of it? All right, bring it in there. Come on, let's go. One, two, three, four. All right, let's go. Here we go. Sickening, isn't it? That's true slob folk art. No. I don't put my nose flute in the same category with my Kopfspiel and my Jew's harp. It's just, you know, pure slob art. By the way, speaking of pure slob art, would you like to hear a genuine classical example of true slob art in action? Now, most people think slob art is, some group they don't like or Ed Sullivan. No, this is not slob art. That's mass cult pop art. Slob art generally is quite esoteric. True slob art. For example, the elephant, the big elephant out in Jersey. Now, that's esoteric. Not many of you know about this. and it's not mass cult pop art. It's slob art. Very separate thing. And I would like to salute one of our spies recently. Something, you know. By the way, if you're curious what that instrument was that you just heard, and gee, I have a note here that says in Clifton High School over in Jersey they have a boys' gym and a girls' gym, but no Middlesex gym. I'm sorry, that's bad news. It's real bad. Well, of course, it is true, and I got a great letter from this person. It says, I am madly in love with you, Shepherd. And at the bottom of the note, it simply says, because I am a girl. Well, that makes me feel a little better about it. And I was a little worried there for a minute. But if you'd like to hear, no, you never know, you know, serious. No, that's what that whole Middlesex thing is about, you know. You can jump any direction. It's just fantastic. But in spite of what Patsy McCann says, there's more to sex than a book you sent for. Yeah, you know, no, it's a fact that sex today is the biggest business to hit. Yeah, really. It's probably even bigger than the beer business. Of course, sex has always been a popular pastime and a popular sport. And that one of the more pleasant aspects of being, walking around animal. However, hey, I wonder if other animals think about sex in the way human beings do. Well, now, wait, don't say, oh, no. Most people tend to think animals are, you know, beautiful creatures. That they don't have, they're somehow perfect. No, not at all. Can you imagine a lecherous turtle? He's laying down there in the mud, see? And he's thinking of this unbelievable, fantastic, sexy turtle. See? This chick he saw 4 years ago go by. Well, you know, turtles move very slow. And it's just come back through his very primitive brain system and his nervous system that he saw this chick, but it's too late now. See, it was 4 years ago at that time. Well, that reminds me of this this great cartoon I once saw, speaking of the theory of relativity, and everything is relative. I mean, and this is, you know, sounds like a cliche, but this is exactly what Einstein kept saying, you know. everything is relative. He just restated a giant cliche. And it showed a turtle, Herb. This big old turtle sitting there. And tremendous turtle. You know, just a big turtle. Big old mud turtle. And his eyes were open. He was sort of standing up on his hind legs. And you see, sitting on his back, two snails. And one snail says to the other snail, "All right, now hang on. Here we go." Herb looks at me dumbly, doesn't see what that meant. The turtle was about to take off, friends. And to a snail, a turtle goes fast. All right, do I have to explain that to you? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, wasn't that funny? Yes, indeed. I can see why Mutt and Jeff are still popular with Aki Dildoc out there. Well, it's all right, friend. Don't let me. Now, we'd like to salute a genuine example of true slob art tonight for those of you who are aficionados of this esoteric pursuit. I'd love to see a show of this guy's work. Real slob art, you see, tends to believe in the beautiful. It believes that it's beautiful. This is a true slob. For example, my grandmother had a paisley runner. You know what is it, a runner? You know what a runner is? Paisley runner, big runner, see? And she had it on this thing called, what she called her library table. Incidentally, I never saw my grandmother ever read a book, but she had a library table. And on this library table was this runner, and it was paisley. Now, it was this strange pastel red, green, blue, yellow. You know when they dip stuff in the sort of dye? It was a strange shawl. It was made in the runner. It had... was like satin or something, but very, very stiff. That kind of shiny material with little hairs all over, like mohair, see? And it had paisley fringe hanging down at the end of it. It was primarily red and yellow. It was a real eyesore. Look, I'll tell you what it looked like. It was the color of a really bad sty. and here it was. It was laying across this table, and in the middle of it was a tremendous portrait done in red, green, yellow, and bilge-colored inks, this tremendous portrait of an Indian with big headdress. And all around it, were these letters that were made out of arrowheads. They had letters, you know, that were made of little arrowheads. It said, "Souvenir of Starved Rock State Park, Illinois." Now that, friends, is slob art. That's true slob art, because the people who bought those things thought they were beautiful. That's really beautiful. And it's like the guys that stand in line at the PXs all over the world, you know, buy these mother cushions, and, you know, the big purple heart, the yellow fringe on it that says, "To my sweetheart, souvenir of the Infantry Replacement Training Center, Fort Benning, Georgia." What the hell do you do with a monster like that when you get it home? Usually they weigh about 7 pounds and they're about 3 feet across. You know, you can't hide it under the sofa. But that we would, which many of them wind up being. Oh, yes, I wonder how many mother cushions wind up being slept on by a dachshund. Of course, they don't only sleep on them. If you know anything about dachshunds, and I'm sure you do, they do a lot more than just sleep on cushions. The dachshund... I know, I have to approach this delicately. I'm sure there's a lot of dachshund fans out there, but the dachshund, let's put it this way. If the dachshund were a human being, the dachshund, well, they have weak kidneys. I mean, you just say to a dachshund loud like, "Hey!" And the next thing you know, you got a puddle all over. And the dachshund would be 100 years old, just, "Hey!" And just like that, you know. Well, of course, I had a friend who was like that, too, so it didn't make any difference. Famous cartoonist, y'all, "Hey!" Like that. You remember Roger, but that's something else. Now, we would like to tonight salute. Bring me a little opening salute music there, please. Yes, sir. All the world, they want to salute the slob arts wherever they are, working and striving to bring beauty to the world. Yeah, truth and honesty and loveliness is the work of all the true slob artists. Here we go, Seneca. A note from one of our spies who sent me a clipping from the Independent Anderson, South Carolina newspaper. The Independent Anderson. That's a great name for a paper, Independent Anderson. And it says, Seneca, South Carolina. And it's from Jerry Alexander, wrote the piece, from the Okeene Pickens News Bureau. Sounds like a great news bureau. Okeene News Pickens News Bureau. And here's a picture of him. This great artist here, shown with his work. And it's a Seneca, South Carolina. The little gray squirrel scampered across the treetops high in the Okeene Mountains, didn't realize it, but they have several cousins who are performing on the musical stage. Are you following this? Another one who is an ice skater, and more kinfolk who are participating in a wedding ceremony. Sounds interesting, doesn't it? And it is. Every bit of it is true, in a make-believe sort of way. I like the kittenish style of writing here. That's in itself slob art. It was carried to its final perfection by the late Dorothy Kilgallen and is being carried on by other practitioners of this art. The performing squirrels are all mounted and have been dressed for their various parts by one of the most imaginative taxidermists in the nation, a true artist, who happens to live right here in Oconee County. Yukon Alexander, of the Shiloh community near Seneca, has been termed by the American Taxidermist Machine magazine as the only, quote, novelty taxidermist subscriber they have. Now, if you want to hear what this guy does, listen, if you want to hear something ghastly, now, listen to this carefully. If you want to hear something ghastly, the novelty term applies because Yukon Alexander, a Salem, South Carolina native, has several sets of squirrels mounted in different settings, and they are authentically dressed according to the role they are playing. Probably the most striking of the various displays... Oh, I don't know how to approach this. Now, remember, these are mounted squirrels, friends. They've been stuffed, if you want to know what that means. They're stuffed squirrels. A Grand Ole Opry set of five squirrels dressed up as country singers, stuffed, complete with electric guitars and tiny amplifiers. Help! Oh. You imagine owning that fantastic stuffed squirrels dressed as Minnie Pearl? My God Almighty, what it's coming to! What it's coming to! Bear Faba, what have you created? This is WOR, and we're here in New York. And you want to hear more about this. Listen, that's only the beginning, friends. This Grand Ole Opry set is nothing compared to what he really does later on. Hit the ding-dong, if you will, please.
The axe falls on secrecy at your Chevrolet dealers. You're invited to come in for a sneak preview during Washington's birthday week, Thursday, February 19, through Wednesday, February 25th. Your Chevy dealer is letting you get a sneak look at the most exciting news of the year. And we mean really exciting. So you'll be wise to do nothing, buy nothing, see nothing, till you see the happiest surprise of the year at your Chevrolet dealers. It's Washington's birthday, but you get the big surprise at your Chevrolet dealers during the sneak preview from Thursday, February 19 through Wednesday, February 25th. It's a great new way to save, and your Chevrolet dealer is where it's at.
Things just aren't what things have been. Chevrolet dealer deals you in.
Come get a sneak preview of the most exciting news of the year at your New Jersey Chevrolet dealers.
Oh, well, actually, you know, the commercial itself is a great example of slob art. You'd be surprised the number of people who make commercials who really think they're beautiful. I mean, really, I one time had the dubious distinction to preside, or at least be present, yeah, I guess I was presiding, at a tremendous festival of commercials in Chicago. And they were very serious. They were giving each other awards. And they have... Do you know that the commercial world has its own version of the Oscar? And, they hand it to each other with great solemnity. And then they show their commercials on the screen, and a tremendous beaded screen, and the guys that give away the award are dressed up in the, you know, soup and fish. They're wearing tuxedos. Oh, it's an amazing display. It would be great just to film this thing from a distance. And they all sit in the audience, and they drink champagne, just exactly like the Academy Awards. They sit around round tables, you know, and there are girls there. And you recognize these faces. You say, I saw that face. Oh, yes. Oh, of course, she's the wife in the Right Guard commercial. She's fantastic. Then you look around the next table. Oh, I know her. She's the one, you know, the one, yes, the feminine hygiene, yeah? Oh, she's fantastic, yeah? Oh, this is the kind of stuff. And they all sit there all dressed up, you know, with their evening gowns on. And then up on the stage is the grand old man of commercials, usually some, you know, big official type. He's the head of an agency, something like, you hear of a Young and Rubicam. It's maybe a Fred Rubicam, or it's a, you know, it's a old George W. Ogilvy of Ogilvy, Benson, and Clodhopper. And he's up there, see? And the very solemn, they say, and now, ladies and gentlemen, fellow artists, it is my great privilege, and as you know, we quite often here in our industry run the ideas up the flagpole to see how they wave, and a lot of you folks here tonight have done magnificent work in the field of the 60-second commercial. And I'd like to pass out to you, those of you who are not going to get awards tonight, the sincere condolences of this committee. And remember, that's how the cookie crumbles. And as we tonight are gathered here to present awards to all of you who have done yeoman-like work in the great field of the American commercial, we like to refer to classics in our field. How many of you can forget the Lady Plumber? How many of you realize the great importance to the average American householder of Mr. Clean? Naturally, we in the industry understand the effect and the true beauty and the quality of work and artistry that goes into making, say, for example, the Roto-Rooter commercial, all of whom... And I'm sitting there saying, I can't believe what I'm hearing. And then they make their final... They give awards, see? And they go like this. You wouldn't believe it. They just go like this now. And now, Mr. Clean himself, the voice of Mr. Clean, is going to draw the envelope that contains the name of the commercial and the commercial performer that did the most for a great art form in the last year. And now here he is, Charlie Applerot, the voice of Mr. Clean. All of you heard him everywhere. Let's give him a big hand. Fantastic roar of applause. And you see this guy got up there, totally bald head. See, he's Mr. Clean. Everyone knows who Mr. Clean is. He's, you know, the great performer. He's the Clark Gable of the commercial world. And now it takes great pleasure for me, as Mr. Clean, to tell you that the winner of the Most Successful Commercial Actress Award this year, the Bucky Award, this tiny silver dollar inscribed on a field of symbolic green, the Bucky Award goes to Amelia Lesbia O'Toole, that fine actress who brought us so much pleasure and so much wonder as the voice of the second lady from the left in the Jolly Green Giant commercials. Here she is. I want to thank all of the little people who made it possible for me to win this award and to take home to my grandchildren the Bucky Award, which all of you know is the highest award that is given in our wonderful field of the art form commercial. And I want to thank Torp Murdoch, the head of the agency, who gave me my chance when I began to do the first Preparation H commercials that I did years ago. And I want to say to you youngsters out there, stick with it. It's a grand game. And I want to thank all of you who voted for me.
Thank you very much.
I'm sitting there. I can't believe what I'm seeing. This is Sheik Tamara. That's enough. Now that, friends, is a... Now, you think I'm inventing this. Not at all. You want to see old Shep do one? If you quick, come on, let's go in there, Herbie. Hit me the Miller music, please, if you will. I'll do one of my own here. Let's go, let's go. You don't have any... You mean there's no music behind this? How can I do a Miller spot without music? What is this? They give me copy. It says the only thing better than 6 bottles of Miller High Life beer is 12 bottles. Well, that's logical. It's twice as much pleasure, twice as much hearty, robust, deep-down, good beer flavor. For over 100... Those words come out just like, you know, classical gongs. For over 115 years, Miller has been brewed with only the best ingredients to give you only the best. Oh, you know, all this copy, yeah. What I can only say to you, friends, is if you're going to lay on, you know, a couple of them tonight, why don't you make a Miller? If you're going to dip your snout into a schooner of suds, friends, make a Miller suds. Seriously, that's the only thing you can say about beer, all its deep-down, rich, delicious goodness. Yet ripe, yet satisfying. Mild, yet rich. You know what? Come on. Get off my backaroni. Just make it Miller the next time. And by the way, they have a news display featuring 12-ounce, no-return bottles for real beer cuckoos. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee. Oh, by the way, speaking of cuckoos of one kind or another, don't forget, I'm doing a live show this Friday. That's the 20th, this Friday in Newark, the Newark College of Engineering on High Street in Newark, New Jersey. I wonder what they mean by High Street. Whew, that's a bad word these days. High Street, Newark, New Jersey, 8 p.m., tickets available at the door. I repeat again, 8 o'clock, Newark College of Engineering on High Street. This Friday. I'm the sheep of there being. And we have another commercial. Let's get it out of the way. Let's get all these little ding dongs. Hey, would you like a really different reading experience? Try Quinto Lingo magazine. It's a magazine. Sounds like one of these papaya drinks. Quinto Lingo magazine. It's the magazine that talks your language, no matter what your language. It's French, Spanish, German, Italian, Russian, English, or Jersey. In Quinto Lingo, the articles and jokes and anecdotes are printed in English with foreign language translations right beside it. You can read the same joke, and even if it's a bad joke, you can read it in 7 different languages. You can say, it's funnier in Russian, friends. It's a translation into Jersey kind of makes it flat. But nevertheless, you'll learn the language, too, you see. At least you'll learn how to tell jokes in various languages. That's Quinto Lingo. Entertain yourself with its fascinating articles and absorb the language in the same easy way you would if you were traveling abroad. Bum, bum, bum. It says abroad. I go by the copy, friends. And if it's the ditto machine that did it, that's the ditto machine's fault. Phone Quinto Lingo at 247-5353, and they'll send you one of these boobies. Read it, then decide. If you don't like it, you just tell the publisher, and he'll stop right then. And he'll start crying, and it'll be a mess. But nevertheless, you call him at the 247-5353. Quinto Lingo. Is Quinto there? Noah, who is a Quinto? Is a Quinto there? Noah, who's a Quinto? He's out at the ball of the game. What's the matter? Well, I can speak foreign languages. Meet the baller. Do a lot of them things. Hot the dog. You got to try that. You can do that in French, too. I'm sorry, Herb. You're very pained. You look very pained today. I'll tell you, I guess it's one of those days, you know, you can't get the image out of your mind of this Grand Ole Opry made out of stuffed squirrels. A little tiny mini pearl. I mean, a big mini pearl is bad enough, but a little tiny mini pearl. Now, I would like to go ahead, you know, with this in case you're interested in taking up this art form, friends. Mr. Alexander, Yukon Alexander, who has invented this fantastic art form of little tiny stuffed squirrels who are playing charades, he has taken great care to insert the most minute details into his squirrel settings. They're stuffed squirrels, even down to adding the sequins to the clothes worn by the stuffed guitar-playing animals. Their human counterparts, as we know, often wear glittering clothes. So do the stuffed ones. The shoes are made from toy clay, and the singer's cowboy hats from cardboard. Gee, that's exciting. My wife, Nancy, does all the sewing of the clothes, says the talented taxidermist. I just try to design them to fit the surroundings. In addition, I think this is kind of a nice little item, a bullfrog depicted as an ice skater cutting figure eights. Oh, geez. There is a wedding stage complete with the preacher reading a Bible to the couple. These are stuffed animals, of course, who are appropriately dressed for the occasion. The reason for using squirrels in particular is that they're plentiful in this area of the country. Alexander said he took a correspondence course in squirrel mounting. He became interested in this hobby, and his first job was was a squirrel, which he mounted as a table lamp. And then he thought, well, I'll add a few chopped walnuts around the lamp base to give the setting authenticity. He did, and his friends loved it. His desire to add that, quote, something extra to the age-old art of taxidermy led him into attempts to depict the various scenes with stuffed animals. He has also quite a collection of animals, which he's about to mount in various interesting forms. For example, he has a timber rattlesnake. He's trying to think what he can do with that one. Well, you can dress him up like a little politician, you know. Put him on a stage there in front of a lectern. You can give him a little loudspeaker there. But don't laugh now, friends. This is a legitimate thing. in an illegitimate way. You can't really come around and laugh at this man's art form. Stuffed animals in the form of Little Eva, you know, playing the big scene, the death scene in Uncle Tom's Cabin. Is an old, don't throw your hands up. I'm going to confess something. Did you ever have a desire when you were a kid to take a course in taxidermy, ever? You never did? Well, are you a city type? Uh-huh. Well, that's the difference. I suspect that most kids who live in the city have never had that desire. But one time, and this was I don't know whether I should really tell you this story because it's replete with bad taste. Well, it isn't bad taste. You know, life itself is bad taste if you're going to look at it that way. It's replete with truth. This is exactly what happened. I'll tell this story. Now, I have never told this on the air because of the nature of what it is, but I suspect now you've grown up enough to understand that life is rough, right? And, life is grim and life is earnest. But that, nevertheless, I was about 8. Now, you got to remember, this was not New York City. Kids who live in major cities, and I mean who live right in the city. Now, I lived in what could be called a suburb, but there were a lot of fields all around us, and the fields were full of rabbits and squirrels and all kinds of animals, turtles and snakes and one thing and another. Now, if you live in the city and your idea of an animal is to go to the Bronx Zoo, well, that's a whole different kettle of fish. It really is. But when you live in a place where there are animals hopping across the yard or hopping into the basement, in short, the animal is a kind of a ubiquitous thing, and he's live and he's real and he's wild, you think differently about the outdoor world. I think that there's a great deal of confusion that exists today. I suspect that one of the biggest sources of strife in this country today is the urban versus the non-urban person. Now, when I say non-urban, I don't mean farm. I don't mean a guy living in a little town called Rabbit Hash, Kentucky. I mean the guy who is not living on a street where 16,000 other people live. Because urban life is a very special thing today. And on the other hand, non-urban life, I think they've grown further apart. That the life, I suspect, 50 years ago in the big city was not really that much different from life in the little city or the town. Even though we tend to, make a big romantic thing about it in plays and literature, I suspect that it wasn't really that much different. Because for one thing, I think the sociological drives and things that people faced were not that much different than they vis-a-vis the country versus the city life. Today, it's very different. You don't find many country ghettos. You just don't. You don't find many, you know, many minority groups taking up residence in one small county in Indiana or Ohio or Michigan. It just doesn't happen. And so I suspect that that life in 1970, the city versus the country, is very different than it used to be, say, 50, 100 years ago, just from what I can judge by reading of those times. That today, the city man lives in a world that the country man, or I shouldn't say country, the non-city man, that's very different, can hardly comprehend. Really, to begin with, let's take a little thing like, say, a vandalism. That the average guy living in the city lives with vandalism so much that he doesn't even notice it. Doesn't even think about it. Oh, yeah. I've seen people sitting in the subway, and I've done it myself, watching a group of kids just take knives and cut up the subway seats. Just, you know, hack them to bits. And nobody says a word. They just sit there and read their daily news, you know, keep up with their Earl Wilson. And they never even thought anything about it. It's just an accepted fact. How many times do you drive along the road in right here in the city and drive right along the major roads? Let's take Long Island Expressway. And, that, Queens Parkway, Utopia Parkway, any of these major parkways, you drive along, and about every half a mile, there is a car that's either stripped, it's being stripped, or was stripped. And there it is, you know. You see guys climbing all over it. They're taking stuff off, you know. Everybody's piling the junk in the back of a truck or something. Nobody pays any attention at all. They accept it. Now, that is not really a part of life that the people in the non-urban area know much about. They don't really see much of this. And if any vandalism does occur in a non-urban area, it's the subject of a lot of talk. I mean, it's a whole big thing happens. But in New York City, in major cities all over the country, New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Cleveland, so on, vandalism is so much a part of the way of life that nobody says a word about it. I mean, it's just accepted. You don't say anything about it. You just accept it. And in fact, you're kind of surprised when it doesn't happen, actually. It's kind of gotten to be a negative thing. Well, now, this is just one aspect of this whole thing. Now, vandalism is one thing. Crime is another. I'm talking about pure robberies and crime. That it is a rare guy who has lived in New York City for any length of time, a rare person who has not been robbed. A rare person. Would you agree that? That's right. Have you not been robbed, Herb? Well, you're one of them. Well, then you're very fortunate. I don't know many people. Lee's been robbed. I've been robbed. I don't know many people who haven't been. It's a rare person, however, who has not at least been around the robbery. In other words, the next apartment was robbed, or somebody on the floor above was robbed. In short, they've had a personal involvement with a robbery of some kind. And I would like to say that on the outside, I like to say, I mean, it's true. I mean, people who live in non-urban areas rarely encounter crime. It's a thing they don't see much of. They read about it a great deal, but actually to encounter it in their own lives is quite a rare thing. So these two subjects right here have two different meanings for people. So if a man is living in a little town somewhere or a suburb or something like that, and he reads about things like crime and so forth, vandalism, they're purely abstract. A guy living on 12th Street, when he reads about crime and vandalism, it ain't no abstract, friends. In fact, even as he's reading the article, he can hear the sound of crowbars prying doors open. He can hear the sound of glass crashing. He can hear the sound of stuff being carted out right now. And so I think the lives have gotten two very, very separate. So you have to understand that they were always separate, but they're getting more so. Now let's take this thing about animals. Now as a kid, I'm sure that the average kid living on uh, on the Fordham Road, he would never think in terms of stuffing a squirrel. Because a squirrel is a very rare thing in his life. When he does, he sees it in the park. And there's signs all around that say, don't feed the squirrels. Or signs that say, keep off the squirrels. Or don't kick the butterflies and stuff. Well, if you live in places where squirrels are a pest, actually, where rabbits are considered a major pain in the neck, and if you don't think so, listen, I've seen rabbits. I'll never forget one morning, Mrs. Bruner next door. It was kind of a sad thing. Mrs. Bruner next door, she went through one spring, about March or something like that. She went through a thing where she was going to plant a garden and out in the back. So she went out there and poor Mrs. Bruner and Mr. Bruner, they went out and they bought all the seeds and junk like that, and they planted them all over the place, and everything was groovy and growing and stuff. They had little tiny pieces of you could see little grass sticking out of the weeds and stuff. Everything was great. And then one morning, I remember it was fantastic. It was like the rabbits were waiting. One morning, my mother says, look at that. And we looked out of the window, and there were about 47 rabbits. I'm serious. The whole yard was covered with rabbits, and each one had one of Mrs. Bruner's plants in his trap. And they were all taken out. They just took off like big speckled birds, you see. They just left with the whole damn lawn. And that was the end of it. Well, of course, at that point, you don't have as much sentimentality about rabbits. When the average city guy, he's sentimental about rabbits because his only real actual acquaintance with rabbits comes through Bugs Bunny cartoons. He thinks possibly when he was a kid he read Peter Rabbit, and that's about the end of it. So I was about 10, maybe 9, and I used to get this magazine that was delivered to me. I got it for a birthday present, a 5-year subscription to Boy's Life, and I would read this thing fanatically. Every month it would come. Do you ever read Boy's Life at all? Oh, boy, and I'd just dig this thing every month when it would come, Boy's Life. And there was a column one time in there. I remember reading some story that somebody had written about some big-time Eagle Scout or something, and he was saying, my most fun merit badge. You know, merit badges are things that kids get when they're in the Boy Scout. They have a merit badge for cooking, camping, handicraft, leatherwork, canoeing, all those things. And he said that the name of the article was My Most Fun Merit Badge. Well, I picked this thing up and I started reading it. And he's talking about the merit badge that he got for taxidermy. Did you know they had a merit badge for taxidermy? Oh, yeah. And he was telling about how he took this course in taxidermy and he got books at the library and it was so much fun because he finally got a hold of the squirrel. And, of course, that part is very carefully edited out how he got it. But he got a hold of the squirrel and he mounted the squirrel in a beautiful setting and made a magnificent lamp out of it. And now that lamp is the source of joy and pleasure to his family. And they sit there, and his father reads his books and his magazines and newspapers sitting there under the light of this beautiful squirrel lamp. And by the way, he made the shade out of birch bark. And it was a real objet d'art. So I'm reading this thing, and I'm thinking to myself, gee, wouldn't that be great if I could, boys go through this period of wanting to make stuff. Girls don't go through that as virulently. I guess a few of them do, but boys go through this virulent making stuff here when they want to make a bookcase, or they see themselves making some kind of a canoe. You went through that, I'm sure. Went through the making stage, didn't you? Making stuff stage. Well, I'm sitting there. Wouldn't it be great? Think how great it would be if for my father's birthday, I made him a stuffed guinea pig. I could stuff a guinea pig, see, and I could make two stuffed guinea pigs, and I could make them into bookshelves, bookends, see, And he had this collection of Fu Manchu books and stuff, you know, the stuff that he read, the Fu Manchu, H. Rider Haggard, and the S.S. Van Dyne. I mean, that was his reading material. And I says, I could just see these two stuffed guinea pigs. Now, the reason I thought of guinea pigs was because Schwartz grew guinea pigs. And I knew where I could get a supply of guinea pigs. Schwartz was always trying to get rid of guinea pigs. Apparently, guinea pigs breed faster than rabbits or cockroaches. And Schwartz always had guinea pigs to give away. And he had a whole big pen of them. See? And I thought to myself, I could take one brown one. Beautiful. See? I'd take one brown one, and I'd take one white one. And I would stuff them, and I would mount them on this wood. I could make the wood in the shop and school. See? And I could surprise them with stuffed guinea pigs. Now, the question is, how do you learn how to stuff an animal? Well, I go down to the library, and I get a book. And it was a book that was listed in the article as being a good textbook on how taxidermy is done. And the book had this whole business about skinning the animal and how you put the skin on a piece of wood. Oh, I remember it vividly. And how you finish the skin and how you clean it all up. And then finally, when you take the skin, you dry it a certain way and you use certain chemicals, which are easily obtainable at your neighborhood grocery store. And then after that, you stuff the animal, you sew the animal and put him in a lifelike position. Oh, you know, there's a whole big involved thing about taxidermy. Well, I read this book, and I thought about it. See, and I thought to myself, oh, boy, is the old man really going to flip when he gets these stuffed guinea pigs made into the form of a bookend? He's really going to dig this. And then I moved into action. I don't want to bother you with the details, but let's put it this way. I obtained two very dead guinea pigs from Schwartz, brought them home, and one Saturday morning when nobody was home, I proceeded to start to work with the book laying out on the table next to me in the kitchen, skinning guinea pigs. Have you ever done this, friends, on a Saturday morning? It wasn't at all like the book. It was terrible, you know, skinning the guinea pigs. And with the paring knife and the whole business of trying to make these guinea pigs, and I'm reading the book, and about halfway through my work, the back door opens, and I'm quickly trying to hide it, see, because I'm thinking in terms, you know, I'm going to surprise my old man, see, with these two stuffed guinea pigs made in the form of bookends. And I'm trying to hide them. My mother walks in, and she took one look, and I'm telling you, it was fantastic. It was like I'm sitting there surrounded with dead rats. And I'm skinning them or something. She says, what are you doing? Sir, I'm stuffing guinea pigs. I'm going to make a book and for Dad's birthday. She says, get that out of here. And we have never mentioned it again. And I have never tried any taxidermy since. But I know about it.